you ever wondered what your life would be like if you had made different choices at certain times? What if you'd gone to a different school? Who would or wouldn't be in your life? Would you live here or somewhere else? Do what you do or did for a living? Have you even met the person that you married, if you're married? Similar to that is the question, if you could go back in time and change something about your life or about history, would you? And if so, what would it be? Would it be something to do with history, like prevent the assassination of Abraham Lincoln or John Kennedy, for example? Or would it be something more personal? Would it be something major and obvious, like the school that you went to or the career you chose? Or would it be something that is more private for you? For many years, I used to think that if I could go back in time, I would try to go back and keep my father from dying of a heart attack when I was a child. Later in life, though, when experience allowed me to think more deeply about that, I began to wonder how my life would have been different had he lived. Would it have been better, or might it have been worse? Would I still have gone to college? Would I have made the same decisions about marriage and career and kids if my father had lived? Would I even still be alive now if he had lived then? This wonderment can provide an interesting exercise in mental gymnastics, so long as you don't travel too deeply down that rabbit hole. This is not unlike the experience that George Bailey is undergoing with the help of the junior angel Clarence. George receives the gift of seeing what the world would have been like without him if history had changed and he had never been born. And I say it's a gift because he's given the chance to see how important his presence and his life have been, what impact he has made on so many people and on his community. And that is a gift, isn't it? It's almost like being able to attend your own funeral or wake and hearing people talk about how much they loved you or how much you or what you did meant to them. It's a way of affirming that who and how you are, what you do or did matters to other people, that you made a difference in people's lives. We are called to live an incarnational life. That is a faith that is more than a mere collection of ideas or beliefs, but that is lived out in what we do, in the actions that we take. The decisions we as Christians make about what we do or don't do are a reflection of our faith in Jesus Christ and how we have chosen to live out that faith. Sometimes those decisions are big, other times less so. But every decision we make means saying yes to something and in turn saying no to something else. Our first scripture today from Matthew comes from what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. This sermon, more than anything else in the New Testament, tells us how Jesus modeled for us how God is and how we are to be as followers of Jesus Christ, juxtaposing what the world says is valuable against what holds kingdom value and inviting us to see that it is our motivation, the state of our heart, that is the key to righteousness or right living, according to Jesus. Storing up treasures in heaven, as Jesus puts it, is to concentrate on the riches, the blessings that come with right relationship, love, grace, and generosity. These are the incorruptible things that won't rust, that can't be eaten by moths, rather than the accumulation of things or stuff that can become gods in and of themselves in our lives. Jesus said we cannot serve two masters because we'll love one and despise the other. We can't serve God and money. So how we spend our gifts and our treasures, not just our money, but also our time and our energy, is the best indicator of what we love and what we value and how we want to impact the world. This week's passage and message invites us to become more courageous, intentional, and visionary about how we serve and worship God through our expenditures. Theologian Matthew Skinner writes, "The true value of monetary wealth, therefore, lies not in its power to accumulate possessions in pursuit of power and comfort. Wealth enables generosity, and a generous heart has its sights set on God." He's saying that, first of all, it is our attitude about God and about money that shapes our generosity. He goes on to say that how we use money identifies what we care about most deeply, what is most important to us. It can tell us what our other gods or idols are. At the same time, he also tells us that it doesn't require first a change of heart to change how we serve God with our money. We can lead with the money and allow that to change our hearts. Perhaps you've heard the admonition that you can't think your way into a new way of living. You have to live your way into a new way of thinking. In a similar manner, Skinner is suggesting that our hearts can be made to follow where our treasure goes. If we invest our treasure into a certain cause or ministry, then our hearts in turn will expand to care about that cause or ministry more deeply. And as our hearts expand, then our time and energy will follow our treasure into care for the cause or the ministry. And he concludes this thought by saying, giving a gift, putting money towards use that promotes God's vision of righteousness, may help a heart receive a taste of what God desires for the world. As Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I don't think he cares which gets there first, because he knows that the other will follow. So then the question becomes more about that idea of wonderment. It becomes about vision and attitude. Do we believe God is a God of abundance, of enough, or a God of scarcity, of not enough? Do we believe God can do new things through us if we are open to hearing God's hopes and dreams? Or do we believe that God no longer speaks to us and that the die has been cast for us? Do we believe that the God who is love desires for everyone to have enough, or that God's plan is for some to have abundance while others have nothing? The thing is, and this is important and true across our faith practices, our view of God shapes who we are and how we are in our life and faith generally, but specifically with how we think about our time and talents and treasures. If we view God as loving and generous, then we tend to be loving and generous ourselves. Conversely, if we view God as angry and judgmental and to be feared, then we tend to be angry, judgmental, and afraid, and that often manifests itself in a lack of generosity towards others. As followers of Jesus Christ, however, our view of God, our understanding of who and how God is, should be shaped by how Jesus was. In this passage from Matthew, Jesus also speaks metaphorically about the eye as the lamp of the body. He suggests that our vision of the world, of life, of God, can either be a source of darkness, distrust, greed, envy, and overall negativity, or it can be a source of light, love, and generosity. It can't be both. We can't serve two masters. But changing how we view things, our vision, requires some inner work on our part. One way we might begin that inner work is to adopt a sense or practice of curiosity, of wondering. When we shift our internal self-talk or worldview from one of judgment to one of curiosity, this actually increases two other attributes. We have more compassion for our past money issues and more creativity as we imagine changing those things that hold us captive to fear. So adopting a sense of curiosity or wonderment might lead us to ask, I wonder why I have this habit of retail therapy whenever I get depressed. Why is it that I need a new pair of shoes or a new golf club when I'm feeling down? This can be a question that helps us to compassionately uncover a false belief about the power of things to make us feel happy and secure, those earthly treasures that Jesus talked about. When we go further to ask ourselves, I wonder what my faith has to say about what really offers the security I desire, we're invited to creatively imagine a spiritual practice, such as making a list of those things that we are grateful for, rather than go shopping the next time the urge arises for us. This becomes part of our courageous vision we are intentionally naming in order to bring our money and generosity practices into the realm of being spiritual practices. One writer, when sharing about the sense of fear that seems to overwhelm her each month when she sits down to pay bills, shared how adopting a sense of wonder and curiosity helped displace her sense of dread. She wrote, "When I feel afraid, for instance, before doing the monthly bills, I've been practicing starting my sentences with, 'I wonder.' And I can say that this curiosity practice has helped me tremendously. Such as, 'I wonder how I will creatively solve the increased cash flow demands this month.' It begins to put me in a state of imagining rather than dreading. Like all practices, it takes a while to retrain the brain, but with repetition, it begins to shift my attitude about bill paying. The idea of looking in to more closely align with God, our outlook, our looking out, requires a deepening self-awareness. Becoming more in tune with what truly feels life-giving and what feels dread-producing will give us good clues about what our hearts desire for the long haul, and therefore how we spend our time and money, what treasures we pursue. As I said earlier, whether our heart leads our treasures or our treasures lead our heart doesn't matter. It's the destination that counts. And that destination is to live in the image and likeness of the extravagantly generous God who created us. In my early adulthood, when I was trying to build a career and family and all of those things that author David Brooks in his book, The Second Mountain, would refer to as first mountain things, I gave to the church or to charity from whatever was left over after the bills were paid and the stuff was bought. And it was hard. We had a house and two cars and two kids, and like most people, we wanted nice stuff. Our priority was around accumulation and comfort. But as my faith journey deepened, I began thinking differently about things, including how I handled money. A couple of years after my divorce, I decided to change careers. I had wanted to do that years earlier, but the financial pressure my wife and I had put on ourselves at that time required a certain income just to pay the bills. I was a captive. I was trapped in a prison of my own making, built out of materialism, debt, and mistrust. After I made the decision to work towards making a career change, it was as though I had been released, but was on parole. No longer captive, but not yet free. I didn't know what my next career was going to be, but I trusted that God did. By the time I made the leap from retail to real estate, I had saved enough to cover 1 year of my former salary. I knew that I could put myself wholeheartedly into real estate without worrying about money for a year. And I knew, having prayed about it for years, that God was guiding me through this. And it was then that I stepped out in faith and became a tither. No longer giving from the leftovers, but from the first fruits, the first check written when a commission was earned. So you hear me saying, right, that it's easy to become a tither when you don't have any income. Well, that first commission was 6 months in coming. And when I sat down after receiving that check for $3,600 to write my bills, one of the hardest things I had to do was write a check right off the top for 10%, $360 to the church. I knew that's what I had promised I would do in one of those, God, if you'll do this for me, I'll give my life to you kind of prayers. But now it was real and was one of those things that both hurt and felt good at the same time, you know? There was some fear, but it was mixed with joy. But that's how I became a tither, out of gratitude that God had led me where I was. I adopted an attitude of gratitude, as they say. Sometimes my heart led my treasure, and sometimes my treasure led my heart. But from then on, I have given 10%. By the end of my second year in real estate, my earnings equaled the salary that I left behind at Kmart. And by the end of the fourth year, I was making twice as much, still tithed 10%. And never really worried whether there would be enough money to pay the bills. However, it took a lot of inner work and faith before I got to that point. It's that inner work, that looking in, that molds the shape of God, molds into the shape of God our outlook. The passage from Timothy addressed this as Paul writes, and understand he's writing to all of us. We may not think of ourselves as rich, but compared to the world, we are the richest 10%. And he writes, tell people who are rich not to become egotistical and not to place their hopes on their finances, which are uncertain. Instead, they need to hope in God, who richly provides everything. That inner work leads us to check the alignment of our money practices with both ours and God's vision. Are we creating the impact for which we hope, or at least moving in that direction? When our practices, no matter how incremental or seemingly simple, are serving the vision, we live with a sense of wholeheartedness and wonder that energizes us and those around us and the world. It's Paul's idea of truly living. Money, when coupled with the alignment of kingdom values and a vision for a more just world can result in the kind of generosity that gives life not only to the mission, but also to the giver. Last week, we shared with you how, thanks to your generosity, our education and worship ministries positively impacted lives. Then we shared a bit of the bigger vision for how God is calling us to make an even bigger impact for Christ through those ministries next year. Today, we'll do the same thing with our missions area. As you leave worship today, you'll receive a copy of what's called a narrative budget, a document that groups everything we do as a church into five areas: worship, education, mission, fellowship, and congregational care, and shows how much we budgeted this year in these five areas. But more than numbers, it shares the broader story of the impact we've made, along with our courageous vision for what we hope to do next year. When our giving serves the vision, then we live with a sense of wholeheartedness and connectedness to both God and community that brings us true life. This idea of looking out after we have done the spiritual work of looking in suggests also the idea of looking out for. Who are we ultimately looking out for? How do we balance our need to care for our own well-being and also look out for the bigger picture? Jeremiah 29 tells us that God has a plan for us, a plan to prosper us, it says. But what is prosperity, really? How can we define it? The roots of the word prosperity is the Latin prosperare, that literally means to cause to succeed or to render happy. Well, there it is, right? Happiness and success are the things that are not just based in money, although 21st century world might suggest that they are, but rather that can be translated into a state of well-being that ultimately depends on our interconnectedness with and the well-being of others. Additionally, the old Latin roots of the word prosper point to one's hopes. Pro is for, and spes is hope. For what do we hope? What we hope for, what we value, what we build is where we will put our resources, our treasures, both monetary and non-monetary. You see, God doesn't care whether or not you are wealthy. God cares about how much you care about that and how that shapes who and how you are. Prosperity in God's economy isn't about helping some wealthy or some become wealthy while others of God's children don't have a place to sleep or clothes to wear or food to eat or access to health care or medicine. We can all share the gifts of generosity and hospitality because they don't rely solely on our ability to give money. We all know people who are extravagantly generous but who don't necessarily have a lot of money to give. Generosity, hospitality, and graciousness are all attitudes that if we don't have them now, we can develop with time. So whether we're able to be monetary benefactors or whether our benevolence comes in time and effort, when we are rich in awareness of how our everyday practices affect others, we can be faithful stewards of how we spend our assets. Now, I want to share four sets of names with you. And if these names are familiar to you, raise your hand. Edwin Elmer Bertner. One person. John and Phoebe Barnes. William Eleanor and Mary Cooper. Noah E. Cornetet. One. The church historian. Nobody else knows these people. Yeah, I don't know them either. I don't know whether they were rich or poor, whether they gave a lot of money to the church or whether they gave nothing to the church. But I do know this. The people who were part of this church nearly a century ago thought enough of these people and their witness of faith and generosity of spirit, at least, if not their generosity in giving, to dedicate the four pillars on the front of the church building in their names. Those are the names that a century ago the people who sat where you sit now Thought would make a positive statement about who we are as a church and as followers of Jesus Christ to the surrounding community. These four pillars from within the church are memorialized now as four pillars who are the face of our church to the community. We are bombarded with messages of what we need right now in order to feel worthiness. Keeping a courageous vision before us helps us look at the bigger picture and weigh our choices in terms of how they support or detract from that vision. In the film, It's a Wonderful Life, director Frank Capra juxtaposes the Bailey family and George Bailey in particular with the Potter family and Old Man Potter. The film presents the collision between outlooks, one of fear, greed, scarcity, accumulation, and winning at all costs, and the other of faith, trust, abundance, sharing, and community building. The difference between the Baileys and the Potters of the world comes both in the inner and outer worlds. Do we reap love and generosity or bitterness and resentment? This week, we're inviting you to look in, to prayerfully consider how to align our outer money practices with God's vision for us. Are we making an impact for Jesus in the lives of people as we hope, or are we at least moving in that direction? How is God inviting you to make an impact through your giving to support the vision, the mission, and the ministries of this church next year? In addition to the narrative budget you'll receive today, you should have received in the mail this week a letter from Greg Shaw along with an estimate of giving card for next year. If not, we'll have them in worship next week. But I hope you will read this narrative budget document as you prayerfully consider this week what percentage of your income God is calling you to give to support these life-impacting ministries next year. Next Sunday in worship, we will receive your commitment so that we can begin the work of preparing our budget for next year. You might think of a budget merely as a financial document, but I'm here to tell you a budget is a moral document. It's a visionary document that speaks to who and whose and how we are. When our practices, no matter how incremental or seemingly simple, serve God's vision, then we live with a sense of wholeheartedness and wonder that energizes us and those around us and our world. It is then, as Paul phrased it, that we truly live a wonderful life. Amen.